Welcome to the Postcast, featuring three-time champion, one of the original 3&D guys, James Posey. I'll be your host, Jameson Welsh, and today we have a very special guest. Former number one overall NBA draft pick, former NBA head coach, and founder of John Lucas Enterprises. Today, we are welcoming John Lucas to the show. John, how's everything going today?
Good. Everything is really good. I'm excited to be on with you, J-Mo, but I'm more excited because James Posey was one of my favorite players, the coach, and we fought left and right for his first few years in the league, and he went on to be a three-time champion. He's one of the guys that I'm really, really proud of, and his family and everything.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. You know, you've been a big part of my career and my life also, so I appreciate you coming on with me. You know, I'm going to start off because, you know, if people don't know, now they're about to find out. Being a dual sport player, basketball and tennis at the University of Maryland, how was that? Like, how was that life, being able to play two sports? And do you think right now that that any players can do that now as far as being dual sports?
Well, you know, Pose, back then, it's really, really funny that what we don't have today are mentors for our kids. So I couldn't go home from when I got out of school. So my dad was a principal. So he made me go to the high school where he was the principal and sit in the gym till school got out. Well, a high school coach happened to be the basketball coach. He taught me a set shot. And then in the spring, he happened to be the tennis coach. And he taught me tennis. And he gave me a future that I've had over the last 55 years because he taught me the trade of tennis and basketball. And I went on to be an All-American in both sports. I was the second black. I was supposed to be Arthur Ashe, number two. But the racism at that time in tennis was so bad, I couldn't use any of the facilities. We played, and I would have to stay with friends from my churches, from other churches. So at that time, it was really tough. And I didn't like about tennis was I got beat. In basketball, you know, you say, we got beat. Tennis, you have to say, I got beat. And that makes it tough. But it was really good for eye hand coordination, really good for having to be, because the position I played was point guard. And so it really taught me lateral quickness, movement, peripheral vision, and how to put touch on passes. Because I also was the number one pick in the draft in 76, but it wasn't because I was the best player. It was because of my leadership skills and what they thought was my coolness and calmness under pressure that I think tennis gave me from having to be out there by myself. Long answer, but that's my answer.
So between the two, you just like your options better, the basketball route compared to just the tennis route. I mean, I understand you was, you know, doing your thing and all, but it was more so, hey, I think basketball is the way to go.
Well, you know, I played both, and I played both for 6 years. I played tennis, professional tennis, went to Wimbledon, U.S. Open, played with, you all probably don't know this lady, her name was Renee Richards. She was the first transsexual, and I was the second black, and they used to call us the odd couple. And so I used to play with her, and we played U.S. Open, and we had the best record in world team tennis. So I played that for 6 years, and, you know, I did both. But, you know, I was the number one pick in the draft. Tennis, you have to go earn your money. Basketball was guaranteed money. Really wasn't much of a decision, but I did do both for a while.
John, what were the challenges coming from the college ranks to the pro ranks back then? Because it was a different game as it is today. Today, you know, there's guys that come in, right, you know, 1 year out of college or 1 year out of prep school, whatever it may be. You know, coming from the college ranks to the pros, what were some of the challenges back then?
Well, you know, the draft, J-Mo, was set up to normally help the worst teams get better. So you were getting a 4-year college player to come play for your team. Now the draft is set up through economics where you don't have to pay young players if they aren't very good. So you don't have to live in a long-term contract with them if you draft them. So for me, I was a four-year guard, 22, and my team was in last place, the Houston Rockets, and they traded to get Moses Malone. And that year we went to the conference finals in 1976. But at that time, the NBA was on tape delay, very drug infested. Drugs were all over our league, and cocaine was very prominent at that time. And that's something that I got involved in, and it shortened my career. But I went back to go play for 15 years. But I was the first player in all the sports to admit to having a drug problem. And nobody knew what to do with me at the time. And we in our league didn't have any rules, any regulations, or nothing in place. So I became our guinea pig for our league as I got sober to help put all of the policies and things that we now have for mental health in our league. So for me, and it took me, guys, once I admitted to having the problem, it took me 6 years to get stopped. So I was in and out of the league. I played with 7 or 8 teams. And as I told you all, I was drafted number one primarily on character. And now I had violated all of my value systems for drugs. So I had to try to work my way back up. In fact, I played one game in the CBA. Then I went to Washington. Then I played with Golden State. And then I would go, because I came to Houston first. I ended up playing with the Rockets 3 times. San Antonio. So I had 15 years. So, you know, the same league that kicked me out, and I tell kids all the time, is the same league I've been a head coach and a general manager in 3 times too.
So who helped you through that, you know, through that stage of your life? And what was your final wake-up call?
Well, I was riding around Houston, Texas, no shoes on, urination all over my body, had just missed the game against the Portland Trailblazers on March 14th, had just signed a contract for $2 million for the next year if I could stay sober from March 13th to the end of that season. And I made one day. The Rockets cut me the next day. They went to the NBA Finals that year and lost to the Boston Celtics. And I went to drug rehab for the third time. And this time, when I woke, came out of what I now realize was a blackout 35 years ago, Pose and J-Mo, to realize that I wanted to stop. I didn't care if I never shot another basketball and if I didn't ever play sports again. I just wanted to stop the emptiness that was inside of me and that hole that I had. And, you know, I got to give my wife a lot of credit. She stuck by me. We've known each other since I was in the third grade. And so she knew who I was before, and she knew it. We have 3 kids, and both of them, 2 of them are coaching my boys, and my daughter runs my company. But, you know, it was her love and support that really helped me, because nobody was fooling with me then, that's for sure.
Right. That's deep right there. It goes a long way. So you want to, I know, you know, you've been in charge of the program there in Houston. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
With the drug and alcohol?
Yes.
Yeah, I had to stop because I set the program up for athletes. And then I bought a team. I don't know, are you all familiar with the USBL? It was a summer league years ago, and I bought a team, and it was just for guys who, I think in the early 80s, we had 163 players go through the drug program, and 25 of them got permanently banned from playing. So I set this program up that would put us back in the same environment with counselors in each city, a traveling counselor, for them to prove that they could be in that environment and stay sober. So guys like Roy Topley, Grant Gondrzik, Richard Dumas, Dwayne Washington, we had a lot of guys who came through our program who kept their sobriety and went on back to play. But when I became a head coach of the Spurs, they made me get rid of the program because we traded to get a guy named Dennis Rodman. And Phoenix was mad because they were trying to get Dennis Rodman. And I had to turn in Richard Dumas for violating the drug rules.
Oh, wow.
And we traded to get Dennis, and they were trading to get, try to get Dennis too. So they made me stop running the program at that time. They said it was a big conflict of interest.
Wow. Now, going in with that, was there any way around that? Because what you were doing, it, not necessarily a conflict of interest, it was out of the goodness of your heart. Like, that's the thing. I don't see how your intentions were like, anything of a conflict. It's more of a say, hey, I'm trying to help someone that's going through some things. Were there any appeals for that, or is there any way around that, or was that decision just final?
We, you know, the night before, I turn in your guy, and the next day, I get the guy you were trying to trade that guy for. You would think it would be a conflict of interest, right?
But it's something that happened, though, right? Like, it's something that's there. It's not like it's something that was made up. It's a legit situation.
J-Mo, this is big business.
Understood.
You know, it's like when I used to try to suspend players for not doing the right thing. You know what a general manager once told me? He said, your job is to win games. You're not a drug and alcohol counselor. You're a coach. And your job is to win games. Your job ain't to worry about what they do. You find them and you move on. But your job isn't to try to give them good mental health. And look at where our league is today. That's a big issue for us. And just think about it. With the Black Lives Matter, with what we're doing down here in the bubble, and one of the boxes that we have to check on the questionnaire every day is, do you need mental health? Because you're just in your room to the bus to practice, back to your training table, back to your room.
Wow.
And we'll test it once a day. You have to answer a questionnaire before you leave your room. If you leave your room without answering the questionnaire, you get quarantined for 2 days. This is, you know, we haven't had any positive tests since people have been here because it is really, really safe, but we're in a bubble.
Now, Coach, quick question here. What's been the biggest difference between the rehab programs back then in the 70s or in the 80s to what they are today?
Well, back then you could get real help for marijuana, which is a gateway drug. Today they won't even let you go inpatient for marijuana. And in so many states it's legal. And that's what happened to our program and why, if you notice, we never banned marijuana from our program about drug and alcohol, because in Portland, in Oregon, it's legal. Ohio is legal. Now Colorado is legal. And in most states, marijuana is now either for municipal use or whatever it is, it's legal.
Man, thank you for sharing that with us. Now,
you know, because we tried to ban it, but you couldn't. So, you know, it's real funny. I do a lot with student athletes in college. And if you notice how Colorado and all the areas that have marijuana legalization have gotten a lot of better players, because we still have a serious issue with marijuana.
Coach, you've been around a lot of basketball. You also been a head coach on a couple of occasions and been assistant coach as well. What's the difference between the coaching styles or the coaching now compared to when you were a head coach?
Well, today, the general managers have a lot of say in what you're doing with your roster and what you did. When I coached in the early 90s and the early, the coach was the boss. It started and stopped with the coach. Now the coach is more, you know, he has a lot of input about who his staff is coming from the front office. He doesn't have a lot of say about who gets on the team. They pulled all that power away from the coaches. So the coach is more of an employee, which is not authoritarian. But for me, I work with James Diva. I work with Russ Double Diva. I work with Eric Gordon, Diva, and me and them go at it because, you know, I'm old school. I'm going to tell you where I'm at. And one of the reasons the coaches on our staff can't believe how I can get away with talking with them like that and getting on them. And you know why that is? It's because I play. And because one of the greatest curses that I thought I got, guys, my drug and alcohol use, happened to be one of the best blessings I've got because it gave me a sensitivity of the, because I've been the first guy on the team, an aging veteran, a backup to the old guy at the end of the bench. So I have a sensitivity to all of those positions so I can speak from all of those. And, you know, if you haven't played this game a lot of times, people don't listen to you.
Right.
Because like y'all, you know, the other day, I'll give y'all a funny story. So me, Russ, and James were in the table. I go, yeah, it's three MVPs in here. And they go, no, it's just two. I said, oh, no, I was the MVP. I played in the Fine Direct League and got the MVP.
Oh, man.
No, Coach, are you in favor of the way the game has evolved? You know, right now we're basically in a game where a lot of three-point shots are being attempted every night. Are you in favor of that, or do you prefer the game, the way the game was played 20 years ago or even 10 years ago?
I'm in favor of the way the game is now. It's prettier. You can't touch players like you used to. And, you know, it's really crazy because we're a big analytical team. And so if you shoot a mid-range shot, that's a shot between the three-point line and the free throw in that area, or the shots Michael Jordan took, they rate that shot as about 33% to 35% that you make that. So they also rank that shot as a three-point shot at about 33% to 35% if you're shooting threes. So if you shoot four threes, I've got 12 points. You shoot four twos and you make them, you got 8 points. Right. So the analytics of that is what we have. And then like when Poles played, you know, they used to tell us the worst shot in basketball is a corner three because you can't get back. Well, today they talk about that being the best shot in basketball. We pay a guy, P.J. Tucker, $10 million just to hit corner threes.
I'm going to have to come back.
So he has the spacing on the floor. And then the other thing that changed is you can't play two bigs in the NBA anymore because the guys are playing positionless basketball. Look at us. We traded, I think, who may be the best up-and-coming center in Clint Capella. And we traded him so we could open up the court for Russell Westbrook because we didn't want Russ shooting all those threes at the way we played. So he was doing as much at the basket and getting us in the penalty as Clint was, and we weren't even using Clint offensively. So we use Russ as the guy that gives us pace. So now the league is all about pace. And we want to shoot at least 50 threes a game. If you heard that in the 90s, people go crazy.
So you have some bigs that's established, like big men, and are very skilled down there. So how do you think those players will, last, or do they have to, their game have to evolve more to stepping out, shooting a little jump shots as well, or maybe even threes?
Well, think about it. Could Shaq play today?
No, I would say yeah, but I would say no at the same time because he would dominate. But like you said, those twos wouldn't add up. The twos wouldn't add up for him.
Like last night, we played Porzingis. I don't know if you all saw our game with Dallas.
Yeah.
And he was hitting tough twos early in the game. And we kept making threes. And then eventually he started missing those shots because of the percentages I told you. And we kept making our threes. Now, we were lucky at the end because of a tip-in to win the game. And, you know, Trey Burke hit all of his shots. And Luka Doncic played well. But, you know, the three-point shot is such an equalizer. Think about it. It's 3 minutes to go. And you're down 12. That's right. Really about six possessions, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I make four threes, I'm back in the game in 3 minutes if I can guard you.
Right, right.
So it's all about the numbers and the type of shots you get and the value of the shots you get. So now, let's say you have a shot blocker and then you put a small in the corner. He can't block shots if he got to stand over there outside the lane and then I'm going to throw it to his guy if he come over there to block shots. And then the other thing is we're going to trap him on any time he gets the ball. We're going to get in front of him. And when we throw it over the guy in front's head to get it, we're going to come and jam his body and make him a pass. And then, you know, the other worst thing when I asked about Shaq playing, we would foul him until we couldn't foul him anymore to be willing to get 3 points versus the 1 or 2 free throws he may make.
Yeah, that's strategy as well.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, most definitely it makes sense. Most definitely.
You know, so like if he's in the game up to the last 2 minutes, we'll foul him. If he makes 1 and we get 3, we're going to be ahead by the time you can take him off the floor.
In 1999, the Nuggets had the 18th pick, and they selected a guy by the name of James Posey. You happened to be on that coaching staff then. What went into that draft pick, and how did that go?
Xavier University.
Yes, sir. Best school in Ohio.
Length. Great defender. Great length. Great kid. And would be a great going with Antonio McDice and Nick Van Exel. Had to improve his shooting, had to keep a floor space, but could guard multiple positions. That sounds like a pick higher than 18th, but I didn't make the call. I might have taken you at 12.
No, but things happen for a reason. I was blessed. The crazy thing about it, I think about when I came there after the draft, I got to Denver. You know I had my first workout with you.
Yes.
When I say between the baseline and the free throw line, I didn't know I could do so much shit in between there. You had me tired. I was like, damn, just between the baseline and the free throw line? I think you had it out for me, Lukey.
No, I knew how good you could be. And, you know, it's funny about our league. People get disappointed when they get traded. And I always tell guys, that means somebody else wanted you. And then a change of scenery sometimes is good for you. You know, whenever I used to draw plays, Pose used to get mad because I'd always make him a decoy. He always thought that he was a big old duck. And I used to go, quack, 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 quack. So he go, I know I'm going to go stand over here like the Temptations and the backup thing. You know, at that time we had spacing. And he didn't realize the 18th pick. It's like, y'all don't realize about our league. If I pay you $18 million and I pay you $2 million, who's going to shoot the ball?
Right, $18 million.
Yeah, right. And what you think would be your best role for you to be able to get some more money is to get all the loose balls, dive, be first at practice, stay late, keep your mouth shut.
That's one of the things that I learned early, and a lot of guys struggle with that, you know, as far as accepting my role. I mean, you're right on that team. We had Antonio McDice and Nick Van Exel. So yeah, they're going to shoot all the balls. They're going to shoot when they want to. And then you told me then that I need to find my niche and find my role and accept it and do it the best I can. And I don't know if a lot of players coming into the league are willing to do that. But I'm happy for you and I'm thankful for you because you taught me that early. And I understood what you said. So I appreciate that from you.
You know, it's real funny, Pose. By you doing that, you went to Boston, got, what, 2 rings there?
A ring, yeah. Started 06 Miami ring, then 08 Boston ring as a player.
Yeah, and then you went on to coach where you got a couple of rings too.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah. You know, the hardest thing for young players, J-Mo, when they come to the league, they all think they're coming out of college. And they all think that, you know, you go, and it's real funny. I have a couple of guys on the team that think that they're going to be able to holler and scream back at James. Man, that's the quickest way to get sent home. You know, this guy generates about $60 million to the team. You got to make good contract, man. Shut up.
Now, coach, how would you coach your younger self as a player? Would you be hard on yourself? Would you coach like anyone else? How would you as a coach yourself as a player?
Well, you know, I was fortunate because coaches let me run my own plays and, you know, they let me design. And I felt very much like a player. There's only been one guy that I think that I have been around and coached that was a better point guard than me and a smarter point guard. You know who that is?
Chris Paul.
We were one. If Chris Paul doesn't get hurt, we might have beat the Warriors in that seven-game series a couple of years ago. I think the Warriors were the best team in basketball. But if we don't lose Chris, I mean, that guy there, man, smart as a whip.
Yes, he is.
About the game and sees the game. You know, he used to tell Clint Capella, and I never heard this. He used to tell Clint Capella, listen to what the defense is saying and then do what they aren't doing. If they're showing, slip. I mean, that right. sounds so elementary. You know what I mean?
Right.
Don't hold a pitch if he's going to slip.
Right.
If he's going to trap me, I'm going to take two steps back to get some more space. Really smart. Now, he didn't always say things in the correct way. He won't always politically correct. He get a foot in that ass now.
Yeah, no, I had the pleasure of playing with CP down in New Orleans, and I understood there, you know, what type of point guard he was. Like, he's very smart.
Well, you know then. You know.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And he could I didn't realize when we got it, he could shoot the ball like he could. He turned into, you know, and we got a Hall of Fame point guard willing to let James do what he needed to do.
Right. Yeah, he
sacrificed. So, you know, it really hurt me when we lost Chris, but everybody kept thinking of injuries. I'm looking at OKC this year, and they're beating Utah by 21 right now. And, you know, they got the tiebreaker with us, and they may put us at the sixth seed or seventh.
Now, Coach, what are your opinions of all the basketball training that goes on from the high school level on up? There's a lot of random high school trainers that are saying that they're basketball trainers that are basically these players are putting their futures in the hands of. What's your feelings and thoughts about that?
It is the worst, the absolute worst, because anybody can put a shield up or a sign and say they're trained. And so – when you're trained, like I'll give you a good example. I see somebody down there doing post work. When is the last time you seen somebody shoot a jump hook?
Right, true.
You see what I'm saying? So if you were looking at an NBA game and you were trying to get your guy to the highest level, what do you think he would be able to do if he was a big guy? What would be two musts that he'd have to be able to do?
He has to be able to shoot, and he has to be able to set picks.
And he's going to be able to have to guard guards.
Right.
He's going to be able to have to switch and keep a guard off that three-point line or run him off that three-point line for 5 seconds. So if I'm training you for jump hooks and blocking shots, and we never down that, you're wasting my time. And then it's so much playing, J-Mo, instead of teaching. Nobody wants to, you know, everybody wants to, like James Posey. I want to claim James Posey once he got to the pros. I didn't do the footwork to get his fundamentals right. I just helped emerge his fundamentals once he got there. But whoever did the fundamental part when he was young and the basics helped him get to where he was to get to me. My job was to move on. But there's so many people trying to eat off of these kids and trying to get contracts and scholarships off these guys instead of passing them on. Just like, you know, if you're the AAU coach for the 15, then pass them on to the 16 coach. If he's 16, you pass, you know, but everybody wants to be able to have say. And part of that is because there's so many single parents in basketball that the mothers don't know. So they get bad advice from AAU people or people who are trying to get involved just to feel like they have power to talk to John Calipari, to talk to Mike Krzyzewski, to talk to James Posey, to talk to, that, you know, they feel. And then the worst thing is for them to try to sit and try to talk basketball with you like they know basketball. I don't even pay them no attention. You know what I tell them? I don't go to the FedEx building and try to tell you how to do the FedEx stuff.
So outside of, you know, I say basketball, but within basketball, you have your program that you run. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I have a program I started a long time ago for my sons, and it was about skill development and player development. When I got fired from Cleveland and we were trying to get LeBron James, I used to let LeBron come work out with me. And I got suspended in Cleveland because I knew we were getting him, but I have him come over. I did the same thing with Kobe Bryant when I was in Philly, when Kobe was like 15. And so I used to let those guys work out. So when I got fired in Philly, I said, teams are going younger and it's no fundamentals being taught. And it's different levels of basketball. And Pose, I don't know if you agree or not with me. The high school game is one way. The college game is another way. Mm-hmm. But the pro game is another way too. Yeah. So it's three different games of this basketball being played. But, you know, people really don't pick that up and see it. So it makes it hard. So the fundamental piece, the discipline of knowing what you want to do, and the teaching. Nobody wants to do the tedious work of really teaching somebody. How about, like, a guy came to, like, my gym where Pose was talking about, and he wanted to do my skill development work. And I said, okay, break down a guy's shot. He thought that was getting reps up. I said, well, look at his feet. He's twisting on his shot. How would you fix his feet? Is it left, right, or would you prefer a jump stop on his shot? What's a quicker shot? You know, and so sometimes people think getting reps up is teaching somebody how to play. But the key to that is, and this is what I've always said coaching is. I said coaching is four things. It's mentorship. You got to get them to trust you. It's counseling. You got to be able to correct them and tell them when they're wrong. It's education. You got to be able to teach them what you're talking about. And then here's the most important piece, positive confrontation. How do I confront you to make you want to get better without losing you, the person? How do I tell you that I am on your side and this is what we got to do without you going left or right on?
You brought up two names, the great Kobe Bryant. You saw him at a very young age. You want to tell us about that?
Well, Kobe, I got two stories for you. Kobe, when I went to Philly, my wife said, I've seen a better high school basketball player than you. I said, what? And she said, yeah, come on, I want you to go see this guy. Now, I was in Philly, we losing games left and right. I said, I don't want to go see nobody else play. So I go over here, and at that time, they were calling him Kobe Bean. And so I went over to the Palestra in Philly, and I woke up, and then there's a guy standing outside of playing league named Jelly Bean, which happened to be Kobe's dad. And I said, Jelly Bean, what you doing? He said, well, I got a son named Kobe Bean that's playing. I said, that's what I'm here to see. So I saw the game. He started out playing the five against a group of guys who pressured the whole game. And by the end of the game, he was playing the point. The next day, I invited him over. At the time, we didn't have all these rules that we got in the league. I let he and a young lady named Dawn Staley start working out with me. Don was getting ready for the Dream Team Olympics stuff that year. So I let Don and helped her get her knees back, but I had Kobe. Now Kobe, when he went to the Lakers, took my trainer, a guy by the name of Joe Carbone. And Kobe, when I knew Kobe was just as nuts as anybody, I had a guy who played for me by the name of Mad Max, Vernon Maxwell. And he and Vernon got to arguing over a 9-9 point in a pickup game, and they were about to fight. And I said, Kobe, you know, Vernon is spit on blast. What are you doing? He said, Coach, I'm just competing. And Vernon came to me and said, that boy, that's going to be special. And then the other story is when I introduced him to Michael Jordan in the locker room in Philly. He came in the locker room and he saw Michael, and Michael, you know, Michael got them big old cigars in his mouth after the game. Michael says to him, all right, he said, how you doing, Mr. Jordan? It's an honor to meet you. So when Michael left, I talked to him. I said, now, if you're coming out in the pros next year, you can't be calling people Mr. Jordan. You're going to play against this guy next year. So he did. And then the guy who gave me the job in San Antonio was the general manager of the Charlotte Hornets. And I told him, if you have Kobe Bryant there to pick, you pick him. He picked him, but Kobe ended up being traded for Vlade Divac. And Jerry West was calling me every day about Kobe. Wow. And that's how Kobe got to L.A.
Wow.
He and my daughter. Now, Kobe went to the prom with a girl named Brandy. You all remember this?
Yeah.
Okay, so my daughter is in the photo with that. She went with Kobe's best friend. And so that's it. Now, the other good story I have for you is I was in Cleveland, and they kept telling me they got a guy better than Kobe Bryant. I said, man, look, Kobe's the most skilled player I ever seen. And then I went out there to Akron and saw LeBron James, and I said, Jesus Christ, look at the size of this guy. And I went to watch one AAU game, right?
Mm-hmm.
I stayed 8 hours watching his games. And so during the game, I said to him, you might be as good as Bimbo Coles. He was a guy that played for me. He looked and stopped the game, started laughing. So he came and worked out with me for that summer. And I got suspended for having him in the gym. And he was the best player on my team as a junior. And I had Ricky Davis, DeJuan Wagner. I had a lot of players on that team. And he absolutely came in and dominated.
Wow.
I didn't get to coach him, but I do see him all the time.
You deserve the credit for both.
Huh?
I said you deserve the credit for both of them.
No, I just was a vehicle at that time. That's one of the things. I don't ever talk much about it, but like when Kobe passed, I've had to share those stories a couple times, and I remember them. And then with LeBron, it cost me about $250,000, but I can't seem for him to give me any of that money back. Now, you know, it's real funny. Maverick, Rich Paul, all of those were little kids with him at the time. That's what I admire the most about LeBron. He hadn't had one scandal, one anything filed. He's been a great ambassador for basketball.
Now, Coach, you have the pleasure of coaching James Harden, who is one of the best scorers we've ever seen. Is there anyone you'd compare him to historically?
No.
Really?
I told Mike D'Antoni last night, he had 49 points on 16 shots. Think about that. 49 points on 16. Now, I think he's going to get even better. You know why? Because he can't go nowhere. He got to eat right. Got to get his ass in bed tonight and be ready to play the next night. So I think his play is going to get even better. And that's going to be scary. Like, we play Milwaukee tomorrow on ABC, and I just think he's going to be – he is locked. You know, we work every day. The guy is one of the – he's got some of the quickest feet I've ever worked with players. His feet are phenomenal. This thing about that step back, and people know it's coming. And he's 240 pounds. Mm. And every year he adds something different to his game. Remember, like one year he was looking for contact. They took that away from him. He added the step back. And, I mean, you know, he's got 60-point triple-doubles.
Right.
Now, Coach, what are some of the challenges the bubble has presented to not only players but also coaches as well?
What now? Can you repeat your question?
What are some of the challenges that the NBA bubble has presented to both players and coaches?
Well, you know, the challenge is that you can't really go anywhere. You have to do what is required. Like today, I just got back in from practice. Normally you practice late. You eat training table, which is a diet meal. You watch your film. You go back to your room. You're monitored. You can't leave the campus. You know, we have no guests. And it's tough. It is really tough. But you're going to see, I think, some of the best basketball we've seen in a long time, because guys are focused. It's nothing else to do. It's no distractions. And you can just lock in and play basketball.
Now, Coach,
I mean, just think, have you all seen the games that have been played so far?
Yes.
Pretty high level for us just to be starting back.
Yeah. Guys been anxious to get back for this moment right here to get it going. So it's great to see. So with the pandemic going on and then the social injustice going on, how is that, if it has affected you, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I got two feelings about that, Pose, to be real honest. I was born in 53 to 73. John Lewis is passing, and at his funeral, they had a Pastor Lawson who took me back through my history of knowing about all of the racism and things going. And if you haven't lived that, you can't speak about it. It's got to be people who've lived it. Like my sons, it is so subtle now that they don't really know what it was as blatant as it is now. Like we're trying to take the voting, the mail, making sure that the mail doesn't get out. Troops in Portland, we have a president that just says whatever he wants to say. And then, and I remember when Barack Obama was president, they didn't do anything to help him for 8 years. And he turned the economy around. And, you know, he may end up being our smartest president we've ever had. And may not get the credit for it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm an Obama, but we just have so much more to do. And I describe racism as a spiritual disease. It's something that's taught at a young age. It's something that's hard to get out. And it's a spiritual disease inside of you that creates fear in other people. You're fearful that somebody may be better. I'm fearful that I may not be good enough. But we have a lot of guys, like for the Breonna Taylor, they've had certain shirts. I know Russ has been really big about what he wants to do as his shirts and things. And I think it is, but sometimes I see some of the coaches and people, I know they mean well, but if you haven't lived my experience, you can't tell me about my experience. I mean, it's important that we have so many people speaking about it and head coaches, but if you haven't lived it, it's hard for you to really tell me. You know, like the three of you guys, you all are black. Nobody can tell you about being black and how that's different except you. You know what I'm saying? What you can ask me is, what do I need to learn? And then I can't even tell you what that is to learn. Because like I said, how many friends that you all have that are white that have had to have a talk with their kids about keep your hands on the steering wheel when you get stopped. Don't move. Don't get on your phone. Be polite. Think about what you're telling your kids just to get him back home.
Right.
Do you think other people tell their kids that out? You know, if you're walking across the street, there's more than three, be careful. Look around you when you get ready to get in your car. Right. And, you know, they say, well, you know, then they try to say that it's a spiritual disease in our society that we have. I was listening to a guy named Cornel West saying that we are the soul of America because black folks have always had, what we had was love. You know, because we came over in ships. We had love and spiritual hymns to sing. And so our way of fighting back was through love. And that's what's holding our society together right now. It's a whole lot of love, self-respect for others.
Now, Coach, quick question here. Where does your hunger to mentor people come from? Is that from previous experiences? Is that just you feel that you're calling? Where does that hunger come from?
It comes from my dad. It's nothing like sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And it also comes from recovery. It is nothing like knowing where somebody's got to go. You don't tell them how the outcome of it is, or you don't tell them how to do it, but it is really fun watching people get find their own destiny and not telling them of what the experience is going to be. You know, somebody once said to me, why would you deprive your child of his experiences? Shut up and just be a guide for him instead of trying to tell him what not to do because you know the outcome. Because he doesn't learn anything if I give him all the answers.
I know we kept you longer, but at the end of the segment, I have it's called Free Game. So I want you to give the people that's listening that will see this free game. It doesn't have to just deal with basketball. It could just be free game that somebody can use in everyday life.
Don't be led astray and end up being led by somebody else. Lead your own way. Because if you don't want to lead, somebody's going to lead you astray. That's one. And two, be to thy own self be true. I cannot lie to me. If it ain't mine, if it ain't yours, don't take it. If it ain't true, don't say it. You know, the one thing that I found out, life is simple for complicated people. Life isn't complicated for simple people. I love you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we appreciate it, man. Thanks for your time. And good luck, man. Get that chip.
All right, y'all be good.
Yo, this is James Posey. Thanks for checking out Posecast, brought to you by basketballnews.com. You can check out Posecast every Thursday on all your listening platforms.
Presenting sponsor of the Posecast is greensupply.com. With everything going on in the world, it is more important than ever to stay safe. At greensupply.com, you can purchase masks, hand sanitizer, and other important health and wellness products, all in stock with same-day shipping. Best of all, listeners can get 10% off their order when using the promo code POSEY at checkout. That's POSEY for 10% off your order of KN95 or cloth mask, hand sanitizer, or other supplies like forehead thermometers and UV boxes. Visit greensupply.com. That's greensupply.com today.